Law and Disorder, the podcast that gets real with addiction, recovery, and everything in between. Hear the 360 degrees with your hosts, Tim Disorder and Joe Law, with guest speakers specializing in every field related to why you just tuned in. Welcome to Law and Disorder. And remember, recovery is possible. Tim and Joe, it's all yours.
Hi, I'm Joe.
I'm Tim.
Welcome to today's show. Today we have a guest with us. Her name is Jessica. Jessica is currently in recovery, and I'm going to let Jessica tell you a little bit about herself. Welcome to the episode.
Welcome to the show, Jessica. Thanks for being
guys.
Here.
Well, I'll have 10 months on January 30th.
Good for you.
Thank you. It's been a long time coming, that's for sure. I've never been able to maintain this long of recovery outside of an institution, so I'm pretty proud of myself for that. I've struggled with addiction for probably a little over 15 years now.
If you don't mind, how old are you right now?
Yeah. I am 34. I just turned 34 in November.
Wow, so just short of half of your life.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, I started out, I think, probably as most people would say that they have like similar stories as far as starting out on narcotic pills. I had a toothache, and they gave me Vicodin, and I just had my daughter, so it made me feel like supermom. I had a six-year-old and a newborn, and it was like I could conquer the world. I knew I was in trouble as soon as I had that euphoria of that I could do anything. I was never tired. Everything was always perfect. So I thought it was all an illusion.
So how, you know, you and Tim have a lot in common in that aspect.
Yes.
Yeah. So where did it go from there? I mean, where was the turning point? And we like to ask that because it's usually the same thing.
Well, family members started seeing me is a problem. You know, they started noticing different things about me that were changing. Obviously weight loss, mood swings, you know, constantly asking people, saying, hey, my back hurts, or, you know, whatever, to see if they had a couple Vicodin.
Right.
And then I was actually buying them off of family members. And they all had like a powwow and got together and basically said like they weren't going to do it anymore. And I had never experienced withdrawal at that point in time, so I had no idea what it was going to be like until I got cut off. And I will never forget my first detox. It was awful. I thought I was going to die. I had to have my children's grandma come pick up the kids because I couldn't even lift my head up. And I ended up going to a gas station to get gas or whatever that day. And I ran into somebody that I knew. And he kind of just came out and was like, hey, do you know anybody who messes with boy?
Boy, and yeah. I was wondering. Yeah, I was wondering how he was going to say it.
There it is.
Boy.
Boy. Yeah. And at that time, I was completely clueless. I've never seen it before.
Tell me about this boy you speak of.
That's, right. I was like, well, what do you mean? And he explained it pretty much the same. He's like, it's the same thing as Vicodin or like morphine or anything like that. It's just, you know, it just comes in like a powder form or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay. I snorted it for 3 days. Mm-hmm. He shot it, he injected it, and it only took 3 days before I was completely infatuated and curious about why it was that he was doing it that way and I wasn't doing it that way. And he shot me up for my first time, and the feeling was incredible. It was like euphoria. And that, I mean, that was the day that I can say that I lost my life, not physically, but
you look back and there are these little like potential turning points where you had no idea how bad the withdrawal from Vicodin was going to be. And it could have taught you a lesson. it could have been like an eye opener for you to say, like, this is just, what have I been doing? I need
I'm
to
never
change.
Going back.
I'm never taking. But what happened is, luck would have it, is you met something of a dope dealer, and instead you went further into the abyss, right? Deeper into the abyss, I should say.
Yes.
Which, just so you know, I got a script of Vicodin for an injured knee. And I had some of the same things going on as a parent and all that. It made me feel like a better parent, made me feel like a better person, and went through a wicked withdrawal that I didn't see coming. And yeah, your story sounds a lot like mine at some parts.
Yeah, it sure started out that way.
Yeah, I think a lot of us, and there's not too many, I've met a couple people that have said that they just started right out to heroin, but very few people have I heard that has, I just one day decided I was going to try it. Most of us have definitely, and we started out with pain pills. I'm glad that the doctors aren't allowed to prescribe them as freely as they used to be able to. Because, I mean, you pretty much, there was any doctor here in Lapeer I could go to, and I could get Xanax, I could get Vicodin, I could get anything I wanted. When methadone started, that was huge. That was awful.
Let me ask you this. When you take methadone, right, because it's on that medically assisted treatment spectrum, but I want to know, in your opinion, when you're taking methadone, are you high?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so you would consider that an addictive drug?
I will tell you this, that I got higher off of methadone than I ever did any pack of dope that I ever did.
Methadone is some good shit.
There it is.
That's like the real, like, you know, it has its place. I truly believe that. Really more so back in the 70s and whatnot, things like Suboxone and Vivitrol having been developed. We talk about that and how those are kind of probably a better way to go now, particularly Vivitrol. But I don't think the layman necessarily knows that, yeah, maybe it's a good thing that so-and-so is on methadone, but make no mistake, they're dedicated to that methadone every morning because they are getting lit.
Yeah.
They're not
I would
high.
Watch people right. Not out on it.
Right.
Like, where they would just be sitting there and they're literally nodding out, and I'm questioning, are they on heroin or are they on methadone? Like,
right.
What exactly is it that they took? And they were on such high doses, too. I know the doctor had me on, like, 175.
It's pretty high.
I was a mess. I mean, I was far worse than I ever was on heroin, and not that I'm downplaying any of it, because it's all not good, but people ask me about methadone still to this day as far as treatment course, and I'm like, absolutely not.
So you're basically saying something that was supposed to help you almost hurt you more.
I actually detoxed one time in jail off of methadone, and I was in a detox cell for 10 days
It where I work?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, Tim, I basically raised her. She's been in and out of our facility probably...
since I was 17 years old.
That's part of the reason I show some compassion to her, knowing that you helped to raise her. I would feel bad for anyone.
Well, I was not easy on her, let's put it that way. But if you want to look at do the math...
Right.
Pretty much her entire drug... problem career, we'll call it.
Yes.
Yeah. Is dates back to, we probably went in that facility, me as a new hire and her as our first time in.
Right. Walking. Yeah.
Probably about the same time, if not very close.
You said 14 years ago? Approximately.
She was 17.
So 17.
34.
Yeah. 17 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I have 17 years.
And you were already breaking out in handcuffs at 17.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's, yes.
So, looking at the history of it, you know, you started on the Vicodins, then you moved from there, you had to find an alternative high.
Yes.
And then we come across this, we'll call him, as Tim named him, a sort of a drug dealer.
Dope man,
yeah.
And Dope Man will sell you a dream and you believe it, for
right,
sure.
Yeah. Right. And how did it move forward from there?
So much happened during that time. My daughter's father passed away in 2010 from a heroin overdose.
Oh, wow.
his body just didn't react to it. Like,
were you using together?
We were.
Wow.
I was actually clean for, we had lost our children. CPS had stepped in and took them away.
Right.
And so CPS was coming to the house regularly. Like, you know, our mission is to reunite you with the children. We don't want to keep them from you, but, you know, you have to drug test regularly. And I was doing that because I wanted my kids so badly. And he was still using, which was awful because it was the hardest thing I have ever had to do. It was like putting my hand on a hot stove daily. Because just watching him daily, like day in and day out, especially the first like week of it, because I was just sick. I was really, really sick. And this was before I knew methadone was ever, you know, an alternative or that they had anything like that. I had already, at that time, I had already been to rehab probably several times. And nothing was working. I mean, I was like, what is the point in keep going back to rehab? It's just not working. Like a quick 20 days is not going to cut it.
Looking back, what wasn't working?
Me.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I was just,
you know. As we always dig for that.
Right.
Yeah.
It was me not following through with anything that they had taught us. The million times that I got asked to go to a three-quarter house, and I should have definitely went, not knowing then what I know now about how effective it is to keep yourself out of that environment for as long as you possibly can. Because, I mean, let's face it, we're all like infant babies when we first get out of, you know, recovery. We need that solid base.
That's very interesting that you said that, because in one of our previous episodes we talk about how difficult it is becoming clean, and then those life stressors, they're pretty much the same thing. You need food, you need housing, you need support, you need somebody to almost hold your hand to get through.
Yes.
Those things.
Yeah. And who else better than people that have already lived it and that who are in, you know, recovery themselves? That was one of the biggest things that I struggled with coming out of any facility or even getting out of jail, is that, I mean, there was times that I would break down and cry and say, like, nobody gets it. Like, nobody in my family understood what I was going through. I felt like nobody could really, truly get it. And then I had to ask myself, but there are people who understand, you're just not allowing those people to come in. I mean, I guess I've always been pretty stubborn as far as I can do this myself and I'm going to do this myself and I don't need anybody because everybody eventually leaves you anyways. But like I said, I mean, I found some pretty amazing people that are in recovery, and I don't think that it's possible to do it by yourself.
I don't either. I'm glad you said that. Yep. And then one of the reasons I'm jumping in is because I know what an addict who gets it sounds like compared to one who still doesn't get it. And I can tell you get it. And what I want the leader, the listener to recognize as you are kicking some wisdom in their direction, and it is hard earned. It sounds so simple when you say it now, the whole like what was not working, right? Like, right. Oh, it was me that wasn't working. The rehabs were just fine.
To come to that conclusion.
It takes a long, it's hard. So whenever somebody finally reaches that point and they get it, it's because they went through a lot.
Yeah.
It sounds simple to other people, but it takes a lot to get here.
When I stopped blaming everyone else around me, when I stopped putting it on my parents, on this boyfriend or this, I mean, obviously losing my daughter's dad was extremely traumatic.
Of course.
I was there the day that he passed and watched it all. It was really hard. I mean, it still is, as far
nine
as...
9 years ago, right?
Yeah. Wow. It'll be 10 years, September 1st.
Yeah.
I'm still really close to his family, and actually my daughter last night just messaged me, and for the first time, she's like, you know, I really miss my dad, Mom. Mm-hmm. And that's really difficult because my heart hurts for her. There's nothing I can do that's going to take that pain away from her. She was two when he passed, and now that she's getting older, she's starting to realize, you know, I don't have my dad.
Yeah, she can process things logically now.
Yeah. So that's starting to come out a lot more. But yeah, I think when I started taking accountability, definitely, it took me a long time to stop blaming everybody around me and everything. Yeah, I had a crappy childhood. A lot of people do. But, you know, I had a lot of traumatic events happen in my life also. But I think when I stopped using that as an excuse and really took a look at myself, that's when it all changed.
Right. And we can go back to some of the stories in when you were incarcerated.
You know, give me that.
Yeah, well, I don't want you to like have flashbacks and get all mad and run out, but I used to
PTSD.
I used to be really, really tough on her. And part of it was because she was delusional on the whole process.
Yeah.
And I'm the kind of person that believes if you're going to sugarcoat it, I'm going to dip it in water and clear it up for you real quick. She's had many times where she's come back and
yes,
she's tried to smooth it over like, oh, I just had a little slip. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, like the one time she was on Vivitrol, right? Was receiving the Vivitrol injection for how long had you been on it?
I was on it for over 6 months.
Right. And she comes back and I walk by a holding cell and I look and I'm like, what the hell? Backtrack. And I'm like, what are you doing here? And she tells me, like, you know, she knows at that point that I'm going to really put her on blast, right? It took a minute, but she finally told me the real reason she was there, and she went to a party or a family get-together or something, if I remember correctly.
It was something like that.
And she had a few drinks, and someone was doing cocaine there, and she decided because she's on Vivitrol, it doesn't affect cocaine.
Right. Yeah. You can't use heroin, but you can use cocaine.
Yes. Right. And she ended up right
using
back.
Using cocaine.
Yep. And that whole process just repeated itself like over and over, over 17 years. And I think this last time that you were there, it was a bigger eye-opener for you. I think you actually took everything in perspective and evaluated it. And you are actually moving forward with it now. You're putting it to use.
I mean, it took... going in and out of that place was obviously it was a nightmare, but this last time that I was in there was definitely the longest time I've ever spent consecutive in there. I did 6 months.
How many times did you
ballpark way
it?
Too many.
I don't think our data bank goes 10, that far back.
15.
Way more than that.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. And but this though, despite all those appearances, this was the first time where you got enough time to
really
make you
think. Yeah, where I actually had to stay.
Like 6 months, get comfortable.
Yeah, you're not going anywhere.
And I don't think that it's coincidence that this is also coinciding with your new way of life, right? Like that 6 months gave you an opportunity to do what?
To think.
And what did you think about?
My life and what I wanted to do differently, what I needed to do differently. It gave me time to think about all of the steps that I wasn't taking, previous times of getting out of treatment or getting out of jail, of repeating the same stuff, doing it over and over, which is the definition of insanity.
Right. And I think a lot of it, you were on the right track. You had set your goals. You did a lot of thinking. You openly talked about it. You attended classes. You went to religious services or whatever. And you were doing everything. And you were on the right track. But I don't want to say going the wrong way. But you just needed to have that little bend in the track to get you right on track. Like where you needed to be. Because your goals were set too far out, too large.
Yeah.
And I remember the day that I readjusted those for you. And I don't know if you want to talk about that.
That's fine. We can talk about that.
So my office is adjacent to our program room. And a lot of times there's the classes going on. And Alcoholics for Christ was in there. And Jessica was sitting in there. And I walk out of my office. And I have to shut my door so I don't, you know, privacy things and whatnot, you know, let them talk with it. Do their thing.
Give the Lord space.
Yeah, and you know, I don't want them feeling like I'm listening to them as
Of course. Right.
So I walk out and I lock my door and I turn around, and just as I turn around, I hear Jessica saying when she gets out, she's going to get her kids back and do this and do that. And I literally turn around and said, "What the fuck?" And then I was like, oh, probably the wrong room to say that at the time. But we had a very interesting discussion, and it was about short-term and long-term goals. And I explained to her, you're not walking out that back door and getting your kids back, okay? And then she openly discussed what was really kind of bothering. It all came out. Like, she's like, I have to do this, I have to do that, and I know now that you know we talk about it, I can't just walk out without a job, without this or without that, a place to stay, and go walk back in and say, yep, I'm here. And she was able to prioritize her goals, her short-term goals and long-term goals.
So, yeah. Okay, so I hear, like, I get it. But without Joe even realizing it, I think there are things that are being left out. And maybe that's deliberate on his part. Maybe he's doing that very deliberately. So, from your perspective, what happened in that moment where you were talking about getting your kids and he was like, that's not going to happen? Was that hurtful to you, or were you...
It was hurtful as far as is not that it wasn't that I thought he was being insensitive or that he was just trying to be mean to me or that he was picking on me. To be honest, it was a very good eye opener. It was something, you know, because most people are afraid to tell you exactly how it is, and Joe is definitely not afraid to tell you like it is. And my entire life, I've had people coddle me and baby me. I'm the baby out of 10 children. So my entire life I have been babied, and it was a breath of fresh air to have somebody really look at me and say, you know, you got this all wrong, you know, that's all good of the things that you're talking about, but you need to realize that there's going to be steps that you need to take, that you're not just going to walk out of here and
they're not out there on a couple of big wheels to pick you up,
right? And it made me go back and regroup and think, okay, you know, he's right. I need to, like he said, I need to have short-term goals and I need to have long-term goals. And my long-term goal would definitely be to get the children back, but short-term is, you know, getting employment.
Housing, food,
you know, getting housing,
yeah, right. The necessities,
right? Getting myself established before I'm even ever able to take care of another human being, because at this point, you know, the county's taking care of me. You know what I mean? So,
what it sounds like to me is Joe helped you to see in that moment that you were kind of putting the cart before the horse.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think when we talk about short-term, long-term goals, you have to define short-term goals as something that you can accomplish realistically in a short period of time.
Yes.
So a short-term goal can't be like, I'm gonna finish this podcast and go down and win the lottery, right?
No.
It's not gonna happen, right? Let's be realistic.
What has helped me is writing them down and then giving myself like almost like a, even having a calendar or something and writing on the calendar, okay, it's January. By February 20th, I will at least have a job or have been looking for a job or have put in X amount of, you know, applications, things like that.
Is that something you do right now?
Yes.
That's awesome.
Can you give me an example?
Okay. I'm still unemployed right now. So it's not exactly as easy as I thought it was going to be, having the criminal history that I do have. I mean, I've been a waitress for as long as I can remember, and it's something that I'm good at, but it's also very touch and go on which place that I don't necessarily want to work where they serve alcohol or like a bar or anything like that, because I mean, I am who I am, and in the service industry, lots of people drink after work, you know, after we clean up or whatever.
Yeah. Service,
you know?
Industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or there's an X amount of drugs that run through the restaurant industries because people are amped up on Adderall and, you know.
I know a girl who in this like at the low end of the service industry, you have fast food restaurants, right? Just yes. In terms of like, and I should say entry level, right? So somebody who has a knack for serving people, like, you know, waiting on tables, but being a server, may, when they're younger, start out at a place like Burger King. What I was surprised to find out is that the restaurant she was working at was, there was a lot of drugs in there. And I personally, at least, associate that sort of thing with some of the higher end restaurants, right? Where there's money, there will be drugs.
No,
but it doesn't have to be that way. It can be like any.
Well, it's just like they say, addiction can hit anybody.
Right.
It's hole in the wall, and it's because most servers are required to work long hours. Sometimes we're required to pull doubles. So you got 16-hour shift of where you're on your feet all day long.
Yeah. It's hard work.
You get tired. I mean, yeah, most people think that servers are just there to look pretty and serve food, and that's it. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of running around, and like I said, people get amped up on Adderall all day, and then they'll drink at night, like when the restaurant closes, to come down from the Adderall, or they'll pop a couple of Vicks or something like that.
Yeah.
It's very common in any restaurant industry. It doesn't matter if it's high-end or not.
Right.
It and can be a little hole-in-the-wall mom-and-pop restaurant, and you have the same dynamic.
And you are smart enough now to realize that? And understand that that's something that you shouldn't and can't do.
Yes.
That girl, to finish that thought, piggybacking on what Joe just said, when she told me that she was in that environment and caved to it one day, I said to her, if you can't stay sober there, you need to quit today. You should mm-hmm. call and say, thank you for the opportunity, but I can't do it.
Not for me.
And that's
why I haven't filled out too many applications as far as restaurant industries because of that. Because I know I've worked in them since I was 17 years old. I know what goes on there, and I know for a fact that I would never last seeing that. It would take one time, and it sucks that. But for me, I'm just not. I'm not there yet. One day, I would love to be able to say, hey, I can turn down temptation. Whatever. Do you do what you do, and I do what I do. Not everybody. And I've come to realize, too, I used to get so angry with, if I'm in recovery, everybody has to be. You know, if I can't drink or do drugs, neither can you.
Good luck with that.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. I've come to realize that not everyone is like me. There are people that can have a couple beers and be fine.
We want people to accept us, but we need to learn to accept others, too, and not impose our values on them.
Right. It's not going to work.
Yeah. You know, and I hear a couple of things, like it might be eye-opening to the listener to get some insight into what it's like to work in that world. But also, I think more important, more relevant, what I hear from you is that you have a good understanding of what your limits are. And you need to. If you're going to stay clean, you need to be honest with yourself about what you can handle and what you can't.
Yeah. And that was also another thing that took me a really long time to get to. I used to push myself all the time. Previous times that I would get clean. And it was almost purposely, though, too, that I would set myself up. Like, well, I can just go here and hang out with this person and it's going to be fine. Knowing that it probably wasn't going to be fine,
Subconsciously an excuse.
Definitely. To be like,
you're rubbing your hands together.
Yeah. Right.
Anticipation. Because then I can say, well, like, it really wasn't my fault but it was.
Right. And that's what a lot of people have a hard time coming to terms with, is they always want to blame something else, another situation or the atmosphere. No, it comes down to, what decision did you make based off of what you know about yourself?
At the end of the day, there are really no excuses. But if I want to be generous and say maybe there are a few, then those would be like the death of a parent or child, or you're stranded on an island all by yourself and marijuana grows. Like, there's not very many scenarios where like it really is okay.
No.
You're very few.
Yep.
If any.
Yep. So going back to the whole process where you were started with the Vicodins, and then you had the, we'll call it a so-called intervention with the family, and then you moved on to bigger and, we'll call it more
bigger and better.
Yeah, I don't really want to use that terminology, but right. In as an addict, that's basically what it was.
Yeah.
And so how did that progress into, I mean, I know your history, and I honestly am very proud that you're sitting here right now sharing this with us. And I'm not going to ask you to, you know, go into details about your history if you don't feel like you would like to.
No, but I
know you've seen a lot of things and been through a lot of things. And I'm just going to leave that up to you at this point as to, you know, from that point forward where you went to that, was it a gas station and got your, we got linked up there. And from that point forward, what were some of the, like, I don't want to say lowest moments.
Yeah, but I was going to say, like, bullet point this, right?
Yeah,
like,
don't go
an
into...
entire narrative of every moment of your life for 17 years. But if you were like, damn, I wish I had talked about these things before I walked out of this interview, what sort of things come to mind that, like, man, this is my chance to share
like
my story?
Your chance to share your story, but also point out how a person, what a person can go through. Because I think a lot of people out there that, some of them, some addicts don't go through a lot of things that you did.
Right. When I literally say I sold my soul to the devil that day, I legit mean that. As far as there, it felt like there was no getting out of it. No matter how hard I tried, it was never gonna end. Like I said, earlier, my daughter's dad, for some reason, his body just did not react right. I wouldn't say right, but he OD'd a lot. He actually OD'd 13 times before he actually passed away. So it seemed like almost every single time we did it, he would fall out.
And that was pre-fentanyl, 9 years ago.
Yeah, that was, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
We see that more now.
Right.
This back when it then, was like the China White and the tar. And, you know, that's. A lot of hospital stays, a lot of hospital times. I can remember one time and I was fully active in my addiction, but he had OD'd and, came very close to not making it. And I remember just walking in the hospital room and the doctor was in there, and I remember just dropping to my knees and begging him, please, I'll do anything just to have you stop. Please don't do this. Don't leave me like this. He never took it seriously. I mean, as addicts, I'm sure we've all said this one point in time in our life, that it's never going to happen to us.
Yeah,
it's never going to be
crazy.
Us.
You can OD 100 times, but you still, I probably won't die.
Yeah, and you're like, you think you're invincible. And you're like, well, it didn't take me out that time.
Those 100 overdoses just proved that I won't die.
Right.
This is when I learned that Narcan is actually kind of bad for you. If you get it multiple times, it does enlarge your heart. It is, it's not good for you. You're not supposed to get it multiple times like that.
Like, are you talking multiple times at one point or over a span of time?
Either or.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify.
It's not good for you. We went through that. Me and, his name is Brent. We went to rehab multiple times during this time.
Did you guys go together or?
One time we ended up going together and we made it 2 days.
You had one child with him or two?
I had one. My son is not his, but he pretty much raised my son. So we had both at the time. We had Austin and Mackenzie.
You hadn't mentioned his name yet, and I was kind of waiting for that. And I was like, if she personalizes him to that extent, I'm going to ask, knowing what I know, which is that he passed away. Did you love him?
Absolutely.
So, and the reason I ask that isn't to, like, hurt you, but I want people to know that, like, you lost, maybe she might have lost the love of her life through addiction.
I will say that I did. I've just got out of another current relationship that I was in for 6 years, and we also started using. At the time I was on methadone. So when I'd met him and he was drinking, and then he started getting pretty curious about the pills that I was taking, and then he started taking them, and then pretty soon he started wanting to doing heroin too, and that completely down spiraled. He's definitely had his fair share of overdoses as well. He's had his fair share of stays in the jail. I'll touch on that in a little bit, just because I'm just going to go back to what happened with me and Brent. So like I said, we went to rehab quite a few times. Splitting up was never an option, and knowing now, like what I know now than what I knew then, and we all say that if we knew now what we knew then, it would have changed things. I don't believe that two addicts that are in early recovery, I don't believe that they're able to make it. I think it's very important to take your time separately and figure out who you are again as a person without the drugs, without the substance, because it's very hard. You guys feed off of each other, and that's what was happening with me and Brent. We were both always very serious about getting clean. We always really wanted it, but we were never able to maintain it, because the one time that one of us was in a bad mood or something happened with one of us, we instantly convinced the other one to do it.
Right, and that's what we kind of preach, is misery likes company.
Yes.
And I've heard that many times, that you have to find yourself first. But I've also seen where I know quite a few couples that have gone through rehab and are currently in recovery and clean for a longer period of time, and they stuck together through that. I guess it's situational.
Yes.
Because obviously there's a lot of factors that play a huge role in that.
I mean, that's just my opinion, and I know a couple people too that have gone to rehab, and they're still a couple now, and they're still in recovery, and they still do recovery things. And I'm not saying it's impossible. I guess I'll rephrase it and say, for me, it wasn't possible.
And that's why you're on the show, though.
Yes. Right.
You're sharing your experience with us. Right. So.
Yeah.
So that's a bullet point, right? And that's pretty heavy.
Yeah.
Right. And not to shut you up on any given topic you feel like talking about, but like, so what's another bullet point? What's another
like moment that you went through?
Because you said you sold your soul to the devil, right?
Yes.
I'm not convinced yet. Convince me.
Yeah. Progressively throughout the years, it definitely got worse. I won't go into a lot of detail as far as things that I did and things that have happened, but you definitely, I definitely did things that I never thought that I would ever do during my addiction. It took me places that I never in a million years would think that I would be.
So to kind of put that in some sort of visual perspective for those that have never been through what you've went through, or for someone who is listening and is not necessarily in recovery or has been addicted to any sort of substance, maybe say like a parent or a spouse, what would you say it was more like? Take your worst film that was ever made about that kind of lifestyle,
yeah,
and make that a reality, and that's kind of what you went through. Is it? Would you put that stamp on it?
Yeah, most definitely. The worst version of me possible. Stealing from people that I loved. Having my children beg and plead. Pulling on my leg not to leave the house because they knew what I was doing. It's heart-wrenching.
I never had that exactly happen, but I do think back to all the times I chose to leave my son with someone else so that I could go spend the day running around Flint.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I just had this conversation yesterday. I dealt with an experience over the weekend, and it was a mother-daughter issue. And mom is clearly an abuser of pills. And her daughter's going through some serious things right now. And everybody's like, how can she do that? That's her daughter. Okay, and I know they're going to end up listening to this. And at this point, I really don't care.
I almost wanted to give the daughter a shout, but
right.
I won't.
Well, we won't. I don't have no problem doing that. Peace out, Natalie.
Yeah, what's up, Natalie? Yeah, thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for listening, girl. But everybody says, how in the world is it possible for a mother to not make that a priority, like the only priority? Like, every parent would live in a cardboard box if they had to and be proud of it if it meant their child was, their health was going to
needs
be
are met.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And I so, can kind of comment on that as far as,
well, let me give you my take.
Okay.
And as someone who's never used, I'm gonna go this route, and I'm gonna say that the only way that is physically possible is through the pills, that they're compromising.
Through addiction.
Yep. Well, they're compromising the natural embedded instinct.
Yes. Dulling it. Just dulling it away.
She's numb. It's like everything's got to be, it's her. It's me, 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 I. And when you dissect that, it's always an excuse to either take a pill or an excuse why she took a pill.
Right.
And that's my take on it, and I don't, maybe you can expand on that as far as how you feel as a parent. Is that true to a certain extent?
I think you're very, very dead on about that, especially the numbness. I would say probably for the last 10 years, I have felt nothing, and very much so because I didn't want to. And so when you see your children like that, am I going to say that at the time it didn't bother me? Of course it did, but not enough to stop, not enough to stay, not enough to do anything other than what I was set on doing. After I was high, did I sit there and think about it? Of course I did. You know, laying in bed and knowing that, wow, I'm really a shitty person.
Yeah. So many of us say that to ourselves.
Like, just,
I am a horrible person.
Just thinking, like, wow.
Not going to do anything about it today,
but
though.
Nope. But that addiction keeps you driving forward with the same behavior and the same habits.
Because it's just like, it's like you're a hamster on one of those wheels.
Yeah. That's kind of an awesome way to put it, if you think about it.
Yeah.
Runs in that wheel, like, purposely.
Yeah.
I mean,
and you just
with
keep,
no purpose.
Yeah. You just keep going and going and going.
And then you get off for a minute. And then he gets back on.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's exactly how it's always been for me. It's just been a repeated cycle of the same things over and over. And that's why they say, you know, it's the definition of insanity. It's awful. The things that you think back that you've done.
Mm-hmm. How is your relationship today with your kids?
It's definitely 1,000 times better. I mean, we still have our moments, and I think we still need some family counseling as far as they need to be in an environment where they can feel comfortable enough. They're both kind of tiptoed on how much they want to come at me with because they're both so scared. Like,
the receipt's coming.
If we tell her everything that we feel, is it going to throw her back into that because we're going to hurt her feelings so badly?
I think that's very insightful of you to say that they need a place to let it out, and and you're the target. And you got to be good with that because
and
it's reality.
Yeah, you have it coming.
Yeah.
And at least they love you enough and care enough
to
do it.
Held
because
back.
Some people say the opposite of love is hate, right? But really, I think what I've heard and the ideal I embrace is that the opposite of love is apathy. When they stop caring enough to say, Mom, you really hurt me, then you got a problem.
You have a huge problem.
Yeah.
So as long as they're still like...
I'm extremely blessed and fortunate that they even speak to me, let alone take my feelings into consideration. I, by all means, do not deserve any of that. As far as them holding back, Yeah, you made a sigh. I know.
Well, what I want you to know, though, at the same time, you know, is 10 months is not 10 years, but 10 months is not nothing either. Not like 10 days. Like, you are beginning to change, and they are beginning to see that. Well, so you have earned.
And that's what's important, is that they do, is that I'm now able to show them. Like, I don't have to say anything to them. I don't have to spout off a bunch of things like I used to. You can always tell, too, when I'll speak for myself, but when somebody's almost trying too hard to prove that they're doing the right thing, they're almost not.
I agree. And Joe, all the time, he talks about how for us, early in our recovery as addicts, our words don't mean
anything.
Right. They don't mean anything.
And that's a misconception. It's like the more they talk about how well they're doing and if they're going out of their way.
It's like, yeah, that's great.
It's like, okay, I'm looking at there's something being kind of
covered up. Yeah. Right. My son used to tell me all the time, don't tell me about it. Just do it.
Right.
You know, your behavior. Stop talking about it. Just do what you say you're going to do. Yep. Because I've heard this song and dance my entire life, Mom.
And that's there's so many ways to put that, but at the end of the day, that's what it is. Your actions are going to speak for you.
Don't talk about it. Be about it.
Right. Yeah.
So you can honestly say that this is your best progress towards recovery. Or
yes, most definitely. And since I've been using so over 10 years, and that's just on like the hardcore stuff, like as far as like heroin and crack cocaine, things like that. Before that, when I was younger, it was weed, ecstasy, you know, drinking, whatever. I've always been on something.
Since about 15 years old, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So
same here.
So my question is, and we were kind of talking about this before we started this episode. We brought up Vivitrol because of the incident that we talked about earlier.
Right.
And you said you're not on it right now. We also talked about going to groups and getting involved in the recovery community. And I think I want to say that Tim and I made some very valid points. And now I want to know from you, now that we've talked about all this and you've opened up about your progress, how do you feel about re-engaging in the recovery community as far as support groups, maybe even exploring the option of getting back on Vivitrol?
I think it's important. I mean, like I touched earlier and said that we can't do this by ourselves. I get a really bad habit into thinking that I'm okay, and that's when you set yourself up for relapse anyways, right? There is thinking that you're okay. Any addict who says I'm fine, that's you know what I mean? We're not even supposed to use that terminology in recovery. I'm fine. We're not, you know, they say that that's when you're setting yourself up for relapse. There's definitely more that I would love to do and get involved in, and I think Tim was saying earlier that this is like having him involved in groups and fan and things like that is what almost what keeps him going, is what is almost like a to fall back on. It's almost like keeps him on his toes, because I mean, not only do you feel like you're helping and that you are making a difference, and then that makes you feel better,
right, as a person.
Even this right now, this is, for me, this is almost like going to therapy. You know what I mean?
In a sense, it is.
Yeah.
And I can understand where you're coming from.
Very public therapy.
Yes. Yeah. Very public, yes.
Very
yes, indeed.
Public therapy.
Yeah. So we don't really want to go too much longer. We know you mentioned earlier you have a dinner date with your daughter.
And I
that's
do.
Fantastic.
Right.
And we do, by no means do we want to cut into that time.
Of course not.
Yeah. So with that, I'm going to go hand it to Tim for a quick little recap.
Well, I guess, you know, I'll just say this. First off, thank you. Thank you for being on our show.
And thank you guys for having me.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. And I, as the addict, as the disorder in this combo, identify with so much of what you have to say, and yet I know you only scratched the surface.
Yeah.
So beneath that, there's even more, I'm
so
sure,
much
that
more
you have to communicate that I would relate to. That, what you were saying about me getting involved I know that the day is coming when I won't have people looking over my shoulder with drug court. All the times I test and all the meetings I'm court ordered to attend. So that accountability won't be there forever. That's why I'm going to the lengths that I am to create my own network of accountability for when the time comes that I'll have to do this on my own, right?
Yes.
Yet at the same time, you also pointed out that we really can't. None of us really can. It's a family disease. It's a disease that recovery from this disease doesn't come hiding in an apartment, right? It really comes when you're surrounded by other people who get it and who will support you and who will help you get through those moments of temptation, because they're coming.
Yes.
You're never going to completely
escape.
You're
never going to escape. And I seen an interesting thing the other day. It said addiction is not only a disease, it's a chronic disease that needs to be treated daily.
Chronic, yes. And you know what? We've never said that on this show.
No.
I'm glad that you said that. And we'll get into that more, what it means to be a chronic disease. That's something we'll have to touch on maybe to start the next show.
Yep.
But yeah, you and I have a chronic disease.
Yes. Yep.
And there is a solution. Recovery is possible. But without a doubt, the best way forward is together.
Yes.
And so hopefully we'll do this together. Not just you and me, but hopefully you and me, but me and you and Joe, and me, you and Joe, and everybody else at FAN, and everybody else in this recovery community in our immediate vicinity. I'd like to see you there, because I know I'm going to be there.
So. Right. And from my perspective, a recap on this whole thing is, I'm obviously going to speak from the law side.
Ugh.
Yeah. Brings back...
Somebody press pause.
Bad memories or what? Yeah. So what I'm going to say is, I'm really impressed at how far you've come with thinking realistically. Because that wasn't there prior to your last visit in our facility. You've making such big steps forward in that regard. You understand what you need to accomplish to get where you need to be ultimately. Like, you're not going to get there just by jumping over everything that needs to be done in between.
Yeah, I always feel very good. I appreciate you saying that to me. That means a lot.
Especially after how hard I was.
I was just going to say that, especially how much we've gone back and forth with each other and how many conversations we actually have had. And if you would have asked me last year, if you would have even asked me last March when I got arrested the last time, if I would be sitting here today doing this, I probably would have laughed at you.
And honestly, that's exactly why we reached out to you, was to prove a point.
My mom called. I'll just say real quick, she called. She lives in Australia. And so that's another, you know, long story too, that she moved to Australia when I was 14. But, you know, and it was exciting to be able to tell her, like, hey, I can't talk for long because I'm getting ready to go do this podcast about talking about recovery. And the joy in her voice was amazing.
You wanna know why?
She was almost crying. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's like, if somebody would have, again, she said almost the same thing. If somebody would have asked me a year ago if I would have thought my daughter would be saying she was going to speak on recovery, she's like, I would have said probably not.
I had those same conversations with my mom recently.
So let me ask you this.
It feels so good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing to be able to know that I am able to do this, that I'm even alive to do this.
But let me ask you this. Now that you said at the beginning before we started, you were probably going to be a little nervous.
Yeah.
I didn't sense that. I sensed it was more emotional than nervousness. Like, talking about your kids and everything, that was kind of like a point where you may have perceived it as nervous, but I believe it was emotional for you because of the progress that's being made. And I don't think you had any issues coming here and telling your story. So my question to you is that something that you'd like to get more involved in?
Most definitely. Because I, like Tim said, there's, I like just barely scratched the surface of the events that have happened. There's so much more that has went on. I mean, last year alone, will be another topic of things that have happened in my life. Yeah. But to be able to share more and now that I guess I've kind of gotten over,
you're broken the ice,
yeah,
a little bit.
Yeah, I've, where it's just like talking. I mean, we're right. Just having a conversation, and to know that maybe somebody will listen to this and somebody will say, hey, you know, either I know her or my story is so much like hers, and
or
just to
even
be able to
I
give,
didn't know, you
yeah,
know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
just to be able to give that little bit of hope,
right.
That it is possible that there are people here that can help, that you can talk to people at any time. I mean, if somebody ever needed me and needed to get talked off the ledge, like I would definitely tell them you could call me at any time.
I was going to wait to say this until we were off the air, but I'm going to go ahead and say it now. Joe and I went into a school and talked to some kids recently, and it's something we're going to do again in the future. And I think that would be right up your alley.
Yeah,
I think
definitely.
That's something you would be so good at.
But now that you said that, we'll go ahead and talk about one of the things that she was talking about as we were kind of getting prepped for this episode. She said how important it is to reach out to the kids. And it's something that, Tim, you had talked about in the first episode, that was, you were looking forward to getting out there talking to the kids in the schools, and then we had the chance to do it, and we did an episode on that.
I mean, they're our future,
right?
Mm-hmm. And I will say this to how accessible that drugs are to them is mind-boggling to
me.
It scares the crap out of me.
So education is the key.
Yeah,
I mean, you
because
have
you
to...
can't. They don't do DARE anymore or anything like that. And I remember my DARE program. I don't know if you do, Tim, when we were in school, but it was a joke. It was like kids don't do drugs.
Obviously, she's not going to ask me if I remember it.
Well,
they didn't have DARE.
Yeah.
I don't know if they had drugs when you were in school, Joe. It was that long ago.
It was Joe was doing like Quaaludes and stuff like that. That was his time.
That's all.
Hey, like we were still on the boat heading over this way,
right? Yeah, on the boat to America, the drugs are very limited.
But it's something that I've been extremely passionate about, again, because I have two kids that are right at that. Well, I have one that's almost an adult. He'll be 18. And then I have one that's like preteen. And she's definitely going through, I just talked to her grandmother, where she's really experiencing a lot of peer pressure things, where people, mm-hmm. kids her age are wanting her to drink or smoke weed.
And that's
or
exactly
vape.
What we hit on. Yeah.
And it's like, I can tell her, I give her my best advice all the time and try to tell her that these things don't make you cool, but it's like really at the end of the day, I think that she's going to do what she's going to experience if she wants to experiment. But if more kids had talks with us and we were able to speak on this, maybe we could hit home enough to where they would think about it before they tried it. Because once they try it, it might be
all
their
bets
last.
Are off at that
right.
point.
Yeah.
So
well, we'd like to thank you for being thank a guest you. Today on this episode.
Yeah, for sure. We'll have to have you back down the line so you can share your success with us in the future.
The progress, yes.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So with that, we'll wrap it all up. Thank you for listening, downloading, subscribing. Please like and share us. I'm Joe.
I'm Tim.
I'm Jessica.
And we'll catch you later.
Catch you later.
You've been listening to the Law and Disorder Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes. Please follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or visit our website at ladpodcast.com. Recovery is possible.